From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
For me to want to see the men who killed my daddy die by the state is just as worse as me going out there and killing them myself. So what I'm asking for is life in prison without the possibilities of parole.
The son of James Byrd Jr., the black man murdered by white supremacists in Jasper, Texas, fights to save his father's killer from execution. The U.S. consulate in Israel says it will file a complaint against the Israeli military for its treatment of two U.S. activists.
I was detained for 48 hours by the Israeli military in inhumane conditions, threatened to be shot if we attempted to leave, and then released with no explanation for our captivity.
And the Einstein Files, J. Edgar Hoover's secret war against the world's most famous scientist. We'll finish up our interview. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Israeli cabinet voted to endorse a bill that would bar Israeli Arabs from buying homes in Jewish communities built on state-owned lands. The vote stirred a wave of opposition, with left-wing and Arab MPs denouncing the bill as racist. Israel has about a million Arabs, nearly 20% of the population. Meanwhile, President Bush announced at a news conference Monday that Israel is justified in occupying the West Bank until, quote, security improves. Bush also used the press conference to repeat his determination to oust Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. Bush said he was deeply involved in military, economic, and diplomatic strategy to bring about what he called regime change. But former UN weapons inspector in Iraq, Scott Ritter, maintains there is scant evidence that Iraq is a threat. In an interview with the Scotland Herald, Ritter claims he helped spread disinformation about Saddam Hussein's nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons programs as part of a campaign to justify military strikes. Ritter resigned from the UN Special Commission, UNSCOM, in 1998, but said his experience then suggested that recent claims that Iraq was developing weapons of mass destruction should be treated skeptically. The day after the NAACP chair assailed President Bush's record on civil rights, its other top leader chided him for skipping a chance to speak at the group's annual convention. NAACP President Kwasi Mfume said Monday, "You can't be the president of all the people when you only want to deal with some of the people." Bush addressed the meeting as a presidential candidate in 2000, but has declined written invitations from Mfume for the past 2 years. Mfume called Bush a likable fellow, but added he doesn't like his presidential practice of divide and conquer when it comes to black organizations and black people. At a White House news conference, Bush was asked to respond to the NAACP's feeling that he was had slighted the group and to general criticism that his civil rights record has been lackluster. Referring to his black Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, Bush replied, "Let's see. There I was sitting around the table with foreign leaders looking at Colin Powell and Condi Rice." Julian Bond, the NAACP board chair, opened the group's convention Sunday night with a speech that attacked the Bush administration's record on civil rights. 2 years ago, he said, Bush promised to enforce the civil rights laws. He said, "We knew he was in the oil business. We just didn't know it was snake oil." Two former top executives of WorldCom refused to testify Monday at a hearing of the House Financial Services Committee, invoking their Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. Bernard Ebbers, WorldCom's former chief executive, outraged some members of the committee by saying he had done nothing wrong, but then refusing to answer questions. Scott Sullivan, the company's former chief financial officer, also refused to testify, remaining silent and largely expressionless throughout the hearing. WorldCom filed a lawsuit in a Mississippi federal court in Jackson Friday, demanding Sullivan pay back the $10 million retention bonus he received last year. Both executives are believed to have played a pivotal role in the company's accounting fraud. WorldCom recently admitted to disguising nearly $4 billion of expenses as profits, sending shares plummeting and costing thousands of workers their jobs. The scandal has been called one of the biggest cases of crooked accounting in history. Meanwhile, President Bush defended himself Monday against a torrent of questions about his own corporate stock dealings at a hastily announced news conference just a day before he set to deliver a major address on corrupt corporate executives. Bush repeatedly dismissed assertions that he failed to properly disclose a 1990 stock sale. He said the criticism is nothing more than a political attack asserting he still has no idea why the sale had not been disclosed as promptly as required by law. The president was also vague and dismissive about the accounting procedures at a company on whose board he served, the Harkin Energy Corporation. Harkin was subsequently required by the SEC to restate its earnings. Republican senators said they'll force a vote today on a proposed plan to store nearly 80,000 tons of nuclear waste at Nevada's Yucca Mountain. The news comes as several wavering senators from both parties rallied to support the Bush proposal. Several of them, including Utah Senators Orrin Hatch and Bob Bennett, were assured if they go along with the Yucca Mountain plan, the Bush administration would help keep nuclear waste from being stored in their states. Yucca Mountain is an ancient volcano that lies just 90 miles from Las Vegas in the heart of Shoshone territory. It's long been considered a sacred site by the Shoshone Indians. Today at Leavenworth, there will be an interim parole hearing for Native American leader Leonard Peltier. And finally, a large federal study of hormone replacement therapy in postmenopausal women was abruptly halted because the drugs cause a slight but significant increase in the risk of invasive breast cancer. An estimated 6 million women take the drugs, estrogen and progestin, to replace the hormones lost at menopause. The results of the study have been long awaited since it is the first and only large one to compare the effects of hormone replacement therapy with placebos in healthy women. And today in Columbus, Georgia, actually yesterday, 37 human rights activists appeared in federal court to stand trial for protesting at the U.S. Army School of the Americas in Columbus, Georgia. The school offers counterinsurgency training as well as combat training to Latin American soldiers. Critics say its graduates are consistently involved in human rights abuses. 10,000 people gathered last November at the gates of Fort Benning in protest. The defendants peacefully entered the grounds of Fort Benning and face up to 6 months in federal prison and $5,000 in fines if convicted of trespassing. Yesterday in a Columbus court, 10 defendants pled not guilty, 8 pled guilty. Shannon McManaman was one of those who pled guilty. Can you tell us what happened in court, Shannon? Shannon, we're going to have to change your phone line because we can hardly understand what you're saying. We'll be back in a minute after this music break.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit. Blood on leaves and blood at the swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
Just suck. For the sun to
Strange Fruit, Billie Holiday. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Israeli army briefly disappeared a U.S. citizen last week, detaining him for 48 hours. International Solidarity Movement activist Eric Levine was taken into custody on July 1st as he tried to enter Nablus to bring medical services and serve as a human rights observer. He was traveling with a U.S. paramedic, a British medical worker, and two Palestinians. The Israeli military detained all five. Their families and friends had no idea where they were. We are joined by Eric Levine in the studio now. Welcome to Democracy.
Thank you very much.
Well, why don't you tell us your story?
It sounds rather simple. We were walking along a road. Nablus is under total military curfew and is totally surrounded. Most of the roads have been dug up by army bulldozers, so there are very few entry points, most of which are on foot through the hills. We were walking along a road, were stopped by a military jeep, told to proceed on in the direction of Nablus, got to the edge of the town, and were stopped by a sniper from a window. He told us to wait. An armored personnel carrier approached us. We went through the normal everyday hassles of having passports and bags, searched, detained. The two Palestinian men were sent on, were later detained by another detachment, and we were told, given no justification, and handcuffed, taken into the armored personnel carrier, and spirited off and held in an occupied building where Israeli troops have taken position. They routinely take the homes of families, use them as military outposts, for lack of a better word, sometimes keeping the family in the building as human shields and hostages, sometimes evicting them totally. And we were held there with no explanation for why we were being held. We got a vague comment from one commanding officer who informed us that we were being held for wanting to enter a closed military area. Repeated questions to what closed military area that was, or what in fact we had actually done or committed, were summarily refused. We were held outside on a patio under the quite hot sun during the day, very, very cold at night, offered one meal a day, minimal amount of water, no telephones, no phone calls. Mother was traveling with me in the occupied West Bank and repeatedly asked that she be informed where we were and that we'd be safe, and that was refused. We were told that we'd be shot if we tried to leave.
Ray Levine is on the line with us, your mother, who was with you in the occupied territories, a consultant for nonprofit organizations and foundations in Seattle. Where were you at the time that Eric was taken?
Well, when he was first taken, I was on a balcony of a house that we had gone to have presence with. The people in the house, I didn't hear the first part of the story. I don't know how much Eric told, but the house had been taken over by soldiers, and the people were locked in the house with the soldiers. And we had gone to the house to try to talk to the people, try to talk to the soldiers, and there was a balcony outside the windows of the where the family was being held that I was standing on, and Eric was in the street with the other people a little distance away. So I was watching him I was watching them sit in front of the tank. I was watching the tear gas. The tear gas came in right in our faces, also up on the balcony, and then I saw the two journalists be taken away in the jeep, and then Eric taken away. I was taking photographs from the balcony.
What my mother's referring to is the day previous to our illegal kidnapping, for lack of a better word. We had staged an action at another occupied building where we were attempting to ascertain the status of the family that was being held as human shields and hostages inside with the soldiers. And we were repeatedly targeted with percussion grenades, and then they called in armored tanks where we sat down in the street to prevent them from blocking off the area, which is what they do when they occupy a building. They roll in large armored personnel carriers and tanks and prevent anybody from getting anywhere near the hostages who are being kept inside.
So when you were then taken the next day, mm-hmm. There were five of you.
Yes.
And were you separated? There were two Palestinians, two Americans, and a British citizen.
As we approached Nablus, this is really shows the sort of arbitrary random nature of who you're dealing with. The two Palestinians were told to go on into Nablus. One of them was trying to get back to his wife and family, a man named Mejdi. He was picked up further on down the road. We didn't see him for another hour. We were handcuffed and taken off to an occupied building, thrown in a stairway, handcuffed and told to wait until we would be dealt with after a certain amount of time, about an hour. We were taken to another occupied building where there was a more senior officer who informed us that we would just be kept indefinitely until they decided what to do with us, and still offered no explanation as for our capture. And at that point was when the two Palestinian men were brought back by another patrol.
Mm-hmm. So how long were you held?
It was 48 hours from about 4 p.m. On July 1st, and we were finally released at about 4 p.m. on the 3rd.
Uh-huh. Incommunicado?
Totally. And we made about half-hourly or hourly requests for communication. We were very aware of the fact that nobody knew where we had been. Marching up the road into Nablus, I had called my mother, Mejdi had called his wife, to inform them we were about a half an hour away and that we would see them shortly. And so we were very aware that nobody knew where we were. They had taken our phones. We explained to the soldiers the illegality of this action, that we were allowed phone calls, and the responses we got varied from "I'm the soldier, I have the power," to "We're the military, we can do whatever we want."
And the response of the U.S. consulate?
The U.S. consulate, I was informed afterwards when we were notified that our loved ones were concerned that we were missing, contacted the consulate. I'm under the impression that they are filing a formal note of protest with the Israeli government. At the last communication, I wrote a formal account of what had happened during the 48 hours. Stating what had happened to us, the treatment we'd received, the normal practice of this towards Palestinians, which really truly is the awful side of this problem. And I was informed that has been forwarded along to the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv, and that they will be taking some action from that.
Is this the first time, if the U.S. embassy or the consulate there does file a complaint, that they have done so?
I was told by the officer at the U.S. consulate that this would be the first time they've filed a formal note of complaint on treatment of an American citizen in these circumstances with the Israeli government. Yes.
That's interesting, considering Sarayda Saleh, the 21-year-old Palestinian American, was killed by Israeli troops in Ramallah. And that means that they never filed a complaint in her case.
There is very different treatment given to Americans and vis-a-vis American Palestinians, and then, of course, to Palestinians and other internationals. Very ironically and very unfortunately, I happen to be of fairly fair skin, I believe that probably has something to do with the treatment that I'm receiving.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Eric Levine, the International Solidarity Movement, and his mother, Ray Levine, who went to the occupied territories as members of the ISM. And what will follow and see what happens if the U.S. Embassy, in fact, does file a complaint, the U.S. consulate in Israel. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll bring you part two of our discussion of the Einstein file, J. Edgar Hoover's secret war against the world's most famous scientist.
In the Congress, do I see the voters, me and you? Last train to Nuremberg. All on board. Who held the rifle? Who gave the orders? Who planned the campaign to lay waste the land? Who made the bullet?
Now who paid the taxes? Tell me, is there blood upon my hands? Last train to Nuremberg. Last train to Nuremberg. Last train to Nuremberg. All on board.
You're listening to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. From the moment Albert Einstein arrived in the United States in 1933, the year of the Nazis' ascent to power in Germany, until his death in 1955, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI, assisted by several other federal agencies, began feverishly conducting a smear and spy operation in an effort to undermine the renowned physicist's influence and destroy his reputation. For the first time in a new book called The Einstein File, J. Edgar Hoover's Secret War Against the Most Famous Scientists, the author, Fred Jerome, tells the story in depth of the anti-Einstein campaign, explaining why and how the campaign originated, providing the first detailed picture of Einstein's little-known political activism. We began this conversation on Monday with Fred Jerome. We continue it today. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks. It's good to be here, Amy.
Well, for listeners who perhaps didn't hear you begin talking about Albert Einstein, start off by just giving us a thumbnail sketch of not Albert Einstein, the scientist, who so many people know, but Albert Einstein, the man of conscience.
Well, contrary to the image of a man with his head in the clouds, too concerned about greater thoughts to worry about the world. He was very concerned about the world. He often said, "My life is divided between politics and equations." And while equations were first in his life, he spent a lot of time on second place. And he gave his name, after much consideration, to many organizations which he thought he lent his name as a sponsor, as a chairman, to many organizations he thought were doing worthwhile things. And so, for example, in the case of as I mentioned, he and Paul Robeson co-chaired the campaign against lynching in America, but he would do the same thing in the case of W.E.B. Du Bois when he was indicted in 1951 for being a foreign agent. Einstein would have been the first defense witness on behalf of Du Bois. The case was actually thrown out by the court. It was so weak before the defense had a chance to make its presentation. But Einstein was scheduled to be the first defense witness. He had volunteered to do that. And I have a letter now from Du Bois, which I got, again, after the book was published, thanking Einstein for his efforts on his behalf and so on. But there were some 70 organizations that he endorsed, generally on behalf of rights of immigrants, rights of minorities, people he felt were being oppressed unjustly, anti-militarist organizations, and so on. And he was outspoken on those issues. He was not one to lie back and do nothing. He also had often a plan of action. It wasn't just, this is what I'm for, so that when he spoke out, for example, against McCarthyism in 1953 in June, he urged witnesses to refuse to answer the McCarthy and McCarthy Committee and other committees, other congressional investigating committees. It was on the front page of the New York Times, and therefore on the front page of papers all over the world. And the headline said, "Refuse to answer, Einstein advises witnesses." And again, 6 months later in 1953, in December, again on the front page of the New York Times, another witness cited Einstein's advice not to answer, which Einstein confirmed. And again, it was a story around the world. Well, that's a plan. If enough people don't answer those, you know, committees, the committees are in big trouble. And he was attacked for that, not just by McCarthy, who called him an enemy of America, but by the New York Times and the Washington Post. The New York Times said his proposal for civil disobedience was unnatural. And so that's a sort of strange. And they also used the term most unwise to describe Albert Einstein. Kind of a strange choice of adjectives.
The unwise Albert Einstein.
So there was a lot of that, and ironically, the FBI file, through its hostility, is one of the few places where you can find this sort of comprehensive view of Einstein's political life, because most of his biographers and the media have minimized those activities. I think that they feel that since Einstein's death in 1953, he's become a saint. I guess Time magazine
55.
And 55. I'm sorry. Time magazine now has finally sanctified him as the person of the century, and in making him a saint, they have politically sterilized him, so that people today just don't know any of this. And in another aspect of this, which I should mention, is that in the discussions I've had, radio interviews and book readings and so on and so forth, one of the first questions that almost always comes up is, what's the connection? Is there a parallel to what's happening today in this country? Is there a parallel between what happened to Einstein, what happened in the 50s, and what's happening today? And I think just the fact that it comes up all the time is a sign of something. And, of course, there is a parallel. And many of the things that happened to Einstein are very similar. I mean, the Patriot Act now has given just to take one example, the Patriot Act has given the government authorization now to obtain library records, library circulation records.
Section 215 of the USA okay. Patriot Act.
And this is very reminiscent of the FBI's Library Awareness Program under McCarthyism, which is what it was called, the Library Awareness Program, in which they went in and took these records. And it was Einstein's response to the book banning, and actually in some cases book burning by U.S. agencies, was one of great anger and one that he spoke out against. You can imagine his hearing echoes of 30 years earlier when his books, along with many others, were burned in Berlin just 30 years before the McCarthy period. In the same way, I think we can hear some echoes of McCarthyism in what's happening today.
Even just where you begin with Einstein first entering the United States, when it's becoming impossible for him to remain as the Nazis rose to power, what he confronted, and a lot of immigrants, I think, can identify, and the group in the United States, if you could talk about this group of women, or maybe they were fronting for others, who were fighting his entry into this country. I mean, at this time, he's recognized as a world-renowned scientist way back
absolutely,
in 1933.
Absolutely, yes. This was a group called the American... The group called the Woman Patriot Corporation. That's their name. They're made up of women who were wives of very prominent politicians and bankers and... politicians and bankers, for the most part, some businessmen, and they all use their husbands' names. They would it would be, you know, Mrs. John Smith. It wouldn't be whatever her name was. And they were organized in 1918, before the end of World War I, with the idea of helping the country win the war. That was number one. But also opposing the move to give women the right to vote. They were against women suffrage. And they were also against other dangerous ideas like socialism, which they said in their paper. I quote it in my book. This organization is against women's suffrage, pacifism, and socialism. And they had a big setback when women got the right to vote. It was a body blow to the organization from which they really never recovered. Their newsletter got smaller. They moved to smaller offices, but they kept on. And they turned in the direction of keeping bad elements out of America. That became their cause. And one of the bad elements, in quotes, that they wanted to keep out of America was Albert Einstein. So when he was due to come to visit the end of 1932, the beginning of 1933, he had already been here the two previous years. But this time he was going to stay longer. He was going to spend some time at Princeton. They filed a 16-page, single-spaced, legal-sized document, which they called a brief, with the State Department as to why Einstein should not be allowed to come into this country. And they called him all kinds of names. They accused him of treason. They accused him of planning to shoot officers. They accused him of all kinds of things. And perhaps the most damaging was that he couldn't speak English. And that's the type of organization that they were. The only thing I would say was that they failed to stop him by a fairly narrow margin, actually.
Though they did get him called into the U.S. consulate in Berlin, and there he was questioned about his political sympathies when refused to answer. Another group started to put pressure and demand that he be allowed in.
And it was within the period just before Hitler seized power in Germany, and if Einstein had not come into the country at that time, one of the first things that the Nazis did was to seize his house and seize his property and put a price on his head. And who knows what would have happened.
Mm-hmm.
But that sort of group, which you could say in a way was more dinosaur than dreadnought in describing them, was nonetheless their document was used again and again by the FBI in later years, and was sent to the army as one of the documents on which they based their argument that he should not be allowed to work on the atom bomb. And
well, interestingly, as we get to that, because that's a very important point, the group that fought for him to be allowed in, another women's group who said this other one was Neolithic or something, was headed by the wife of the head of General Electric.
That's right. They were Einstein at the time was a popular, famous scientist who really could have added prestige to any country that he worked in. And I think these more centrist corporate wives, if you will, saw that. They saw the value of Einstein to America's prestige.
Well, let's talk about this. By the way, we're talking to Fred Jerome. The Einstein File, J. Edgar Hoover's Secret War Against the World's Most Famous Scientist is his book. It is really incredible. For all of the name recognition that Albert Einstein has, and certainly we know E equals MC squared, whether people understand what it is or not, certainly most people did not know about his politics. You talk about him being prevented from working on the atom bomb.
And most people think he was the father of the atom bomb, and partly because of the equation E equals MC squared. But I know I grew up, and my kids grew up, thinking he worked on the atom bomb. And we always had some question about, or wonder how he felt or whatever. But in fact, he did not work on the atom bomb, because the Army Intelligence, G2, with the full cooperation of J. Edgar Hoover, based on documents Hoover sent to the Army Intelligence, refused to give him clearance. And so he sat in Princeton while all of his friends and associates went off to Los Alamos or wherever they went to work on the bomb. Even though a year earlier he had written the letter to Roosevelt, he and Leo Szilard had written a letter to Roosevelt urging Roosevelt to start the atom bomb project. And it's sort of one of the ironies of history. I think if I go into some detail as to why they may have wanted him out of that project, I think primarily it's because he would have had a tremendous influence in that project. The project was run by the Army, although the work was done by the scientists, and there was this tension between the Army and the scientists all along. And a scientist like Einstein in that situation could easily have disrupted the Army's plans. When it came to pass, I mean, they in the beginning, they all thought they were building a bomb to use against the Nazis, or to protect us against the Nazis, or to threaten to use against the Nazis. By the end of the project, it was clear it was not going to be used against the Germans, that it was going to be used either against the Russians or the Japanese. And in fact, it was used against the Japanese. And many of the scientists who worked on the project were very upset by it. One actually walked out, Joe Rotblat, a British physicist. And several of them tried to convince Roosevelt not to use it against the Japanese. And Einstein wrote a letter to Roosevelt, even though he wasn't on the project, which they found on Roosevelt's desk the morning after he died. They found Einstein's letter on Roosevelt's desk the morning after Roosevelt died. If Einstein had been working on that project and he had walked out instead of Rotblat, or with Rotblat, I think it would have had a much bigger influence on things. I think they really didn't want anybody working on that project with that much clout. So anyway, he was barred. And this is one of the things brought out in this book, which is not known generally by anybody.
Finally, talking about Einstein as a spy and Spy Hunt 2, Operation Cable Drop, and calling him an undesirable alien should give comfort to many immigrants in this country who have been called that.
That's right. I want to mention one other thing before we get to this, which is that the 1,800-page FBI file, which I have, which I based this book on, has not been released by the FBI publicly, although it should have been. There's no reason they haven't released it. They gave it to me 2 years ago. We expected it to be released. They have put, with a great deal of fanfare, they put some of their files online for the public. It was a big story in the Times, including an abbreviated version of Einstein's file, a 1,400-page version, which leaves out things like the wiretapping and the mail searches and the garbage searches and several other things. So we've decided to put the 1,800 pages online ourselves, and we're going to put it on the web page for the Einstein file, at least initially, which is www.theeinsteinfile.com. And people starting this morning can actually get the first section of the Einstein file, the unredacted version of the Einstein file. It still has a few things blacked out, but far less than the 1,400 pages which the FBI has put online. And it would be, I would like to suggest publicly, and get anybody else to suggest, that the FBI ought to do this so we wouldn't have to be bothered with it.
But the FBI still refers to him and his communist affiliation, is that right, in this file?
In their file, they have a cover sheet with a paragraph. And on that, it's one paragraph. Anybody can get it. It refers to their investigation of Albert Einstein because of his Communist Party affiliation. And this just isn't true. And in fact, it almost isn't alleged in their file. May have been alleged by one or another informant, but it's certainly not a main theme of their file. But they put it on the cover, and at least one reporter called them to try to get them to comment on it. Do you still think this is true? Is this right? No comment. So it's another project people might want to try.
His being called an undesirable alien and the spy hunt, Operation Cable Drop.
In 1950, the Immigration and Naturalization Authority, with the total help of Hoover and documents from Hoover, launched an actual project to denaturalize and then deport Einstein. He was a naturalized citizen in 1940. And their idea was they could denaturalize him, as they were doing with other people, and then deport him as an undesirable alien. And they collected quite a file on him, which I was able to get, most of which I was able to get. Much of it came from the House Un-American Activities Committee. And there were all these allegations that were the same as are in the FBI file, that he supported the Spanish-American veterans of the Lincoln Brigade soldiers who fought in the Spanish-American War.
In the Spanish Civil War.
I'm sorry. And he supported, anyway, there's a whole slew of issues like that, immigrants' rights. And based on that, he should be denaturalized and deported. Well, they didn't. He died before that project ended, but they did manage to take him out of a booklet which they give to all citizens, all potential citizens, called Gateway to Freedom or Gateway to Democracy or something like that. And in that booklet, there's a section on freedom of speech, and they quote these famous people telling future citizens on how great America is and how great freedom of speech is. And one of the people they quote is Albert Einstein. And that book comes out every 5 years. In the 1952 edition of that book, it's exactly the same as the 1947 edition, except Albert Einstein has been deleted from the book. And the historian of the INS told me that she knew for a fact that they checked those names against the House Un-American Activities Committee investigations, and when they found a name that came up in UX hearings, they took it out of the book. And in this case, it was Einstein. This is in the section called Freedom of Speech, Freedom of Expression, in this book for citizens. So, and then Hoover had a 5-year campaign to try to prove Einstein was linked to some Soviet spy ring, because that was really the only way he was going to nail Einstein. He couldn't come out and say Einstein belonged to the Lincoln Brigade veterans, because Einstein wanted everybody to know that. He couldn't come out and say that Einstein supported Paul Robeson in the anti-lynching campaign, because he wanted everybody to know that. So the only thing he could do in Einstein's case was to try to come up with something that would really be un-American, and that would be a spy for the Russians. And so he pursued these leads, which were questionable to begin with, and got more questionable as he pursued them. But he kept at it tenaciously for 5 years. And I won't tell you the outcome of the story because it's in the book, but anyway, it's an interesting, and there are some people who will still argue that Einstein had espionage connections. Hoover, despite the fact that Hoover didn't draw that conclusion, there's still some.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Fred Jerome. The Einstein File, J. Edgar Hoover's Secret War Against the World's Most Famous Scientist. This may be a story about a major FBI file in history, 1,800 pages, though it doesn't compare to some. We hope we're just looking at history, though a lot of what you describe here, you can see some similarities with today, and we hope it doesn't develop full-blown the way it happened then.
We hope.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Lovers of the light and builders of nations, we're seekers of truth and keepers of faith, makers of peace, wisdom of the ages. We are our grandmother's prayers. We are our grandfather's dreamings. We are the breath of the ancestors. We are the spirit of God. We're mothers of courage and fathers of time. We're daughters of dust and sons of great visions. We're sisters of mercy and brothers of love. We're lovers of life and builders of nations. We're seekers of truth and keepers of faith. We're makers of peace and wisdom of ages. We are our grandmother's prayers, and we are our grandfather's dreams.
We are Sweet Honey in the Rock here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. It was one of the most horrifying and unforgettable events in the country's recent history. In the pre-dawn hours of June 7, 1998, a black man named James Byrd Jr. was walking home from a party in Jasper, Texas, when he was stopped by three white men, John William King, Lawrence Russell Brewer, Sean Berry. They were cruising, drinking beer. They offered Byrd a ride home. He got in the bed of their pickup truck, but they didn't take him home. They drove him to a desolate wooded road east of town, chained him to the back of the truck by his ankles, and dragged him for more than 3 miles along the road. By the time the men untied his body from the back of the truck, James Byrd's head and right arm had been severed. They ditched his torso at the gate of one of Jasper County's oldest black cemeteries. That morning, the county sheriff found a lighter with 3 interlocking K's on the blood trail on the road. It was the first of many signs that the murder was an act of white supremacy. John William King was the first of the 3 to go to trial. He was a member of the Confederate Knights of America, a small North Carolina faction of the Ku Klux Klan, decorated with tattoos of a black man lynched from a cross, a Confederate flag, a Nazi swastika, and the words Aryan Pride. King was convicted in 1999 and sentenced to death. He was 24 years old. He was the first white person in Texas to be sent to death row for the murder of an African American since the state resumed capital punishment in the mid-1970s. Lawrence Brewer was also sentenced to die. Sean Berry was sentenced to life in prison. But now the son of James Byrd is fighting to prevent the execution of John William King, who's nearly exhausted his state appeals on the death penalty. Last Wednesday, Ross Byrd led a fast and prayer vigil outside the Walls Unit in Huntsville, Texas, to fight for the life of his father's killer. He was joined by longtime social activist Dick Gregory and Martin Luther King III, the head of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Ross Byrd now joins us on the line, the only son of the late James Byrd, Jr. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about why you have decided to fight for the life of your father's murderer?
Well, my main reason is the joy of life, mainly. You know, I don't believe that anyone should be able to take the life from anyone, not a state or a government or who's ever taking the life. I believe God gave us life, and he's the one that should be able to take life.
Have you spoken to King, John William King, in jail?
No. There's no conversation that I need to speak with him about.
When your father was killed, where were you?
I was in the military, serving in basic training, Fort Benning, Georgia, when I received a phone call from CQ.
And your response at the time that the two of these three men were sentenced to death, how did you feel then?
Right. At the time, I was very ignorant to the situation, just really looking for revenge. And revenge is not the key in this situation. We're trying to better for the future, and abolishing the death penalty would be a very big step into preparing for the future.
We're also joined on the phone by Gloria Rubeck, who is speaking to us from Houston with the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. How significant is Ross Byrd's statement in terms of the whole movement in Texas against the death penalty?
Well, I think that what Ross has done has added more fuel to the fire that's burning against the death penalty. We've had two recent Supreme Court decisions that were favorable. We had the federal court in New York say that the federal death penalty was unconstitutional. And then added on top of that publicity is a young man whose father was the victim of the most horrific hate crime in recent history, who's had the courage to come out and say that he is not for executions. He doesn't want this blood on his hands. So I think that this is a very historical moment for the struggle against the death penalty, to have young Ross Byrd's voice added to the many voices around the country against the death penalty. And when we were in front of the Walls unit earlier this week, Martin Luther King said that what Ross has done puts him standing head and shoulders above a whole lot of people in this nation, including the justices on the Supreme Court, who can rationalize what Martin Luther King called state-sanctioned terrorism, which is the death penalty. But I think Ross has taken a very historic stand, and we are very grateful that he has done this.
Ross, how do you think your father would feel about the stance you're taking?
I believe that he would be very proud of me, knowing that I'm doing the right thing. Because, you know, Jane Berry, he was not a killer. He didn't have a killer mind. You know, he loved life, loved living life just as I do. And I believe that he knows that I'm doing the right thing.
What are your views of other people on death row? For example, other people killed, like, well, Gary Graham, Chaka Sankofa.
Right. Like, that just shows you that no state should be able to kill a person without even having all the reliable evidence and other things that go on with the case. It's like there's another brother on death row right now. He's been locked up for 22 years, Mumia Abu Jamal, and evidence has already came to the surface stating that this man is innocent beyond a reasonable doubt, and yet and still he's still on death row.
Do you plan on taking your protest against the death penalty beyond the Walls unit, where you were outside in a vigil against the execution of your father's murderer.
Right. I want this to, I'm trying to abolish the death penalty across the country.
How has your family responded to you taking this stance?
My family's behind me 100%.
Do they oppose the death penalty as well?
Right.
Your sisters?
Right. No, my family believe in God, and I believe that anyone else that believe in God to remember the first commandment, thou shalt not kill. And, you know, there's nothing around it that can give you justification to go around the first amendment and start killing. It's time to stop the killing.
How does it feel to live in a state that many have called the death penalty capital of the Western world?
Right. It's just, you know, it's very sad that I'm still living in this time, but, you know, maybe we can start making a change right now and start heading for the future.
Gloria Ruback of the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement, can you tell us a little bit about the family of John William King?
Well, John William King and actually all three men that were guilty of this crime of murdering James Byrd come from Jasper, Texas, which is part of East Texas. And East Texas, Texas is a very big state, but the eastern part of the state that borders Louisiana is known as Klan country. I know that John King's father has made statements that he didn't raise his son that way. But I would imagine, being a young white man growing up in Jasper, with the history I know of the Ku Klux Klan activities and lynchings that have historically taken place there, that he was became part of that racist culture. A friend of mine whose family is from East Texas, who's in his, I guess, almost 60 now, said when he was a young child, his grandmother would tell him about people being drugged to death. But at that time, it wasn't behind a pickup truck. It was behind a horse and buggy. So what happened to James Byrd is part of the ugly history of East Texas, the Klan country, the piney woods, where there's always a hanging tree. And even today in East Texas, I was driving to death row a few weeks ago, and I saw the Ku Klux Klan in East Texas standing out on the street, waving the American flag, the Confederate flag, and being protected by policemen as maybe six or eight of them stood there waving their flags. So the Klan is still active in East Texas. They openly recruit, and they do it within the prison system. I've been sent flyers that prisoners have taken off bulletin boards in prisons where the guards have put them up, and they're recruiting members for the Ku Klux Klan.
Can you, Ross Byrd, describe the vigil and the fast and the gathering that you engaged in a few days ago outside death row in Texas?
Yes, it was a very, very historic event, you know, just being there, being in the presence of so many people that have been lost, you know, standing out there for that whole night. You know, there wasn't any sleep. No, I couldn't sleep. Matter of fact, I stayed up 24 more hours after that, just reflecting on what I thought of when I was there. You know, it's not a good situation to be in when you're incarcerated. And just think, on top of that, when you're facing death.
The building that we were standing in front of has, just since 1982, when executions resumed in Texas, 274 people have been put to death there. That's a lot of people, and the 275th is tomorrow night.
Will you be there, Ross Byrd?
Oh, I'm not sure right now.
Mm-hmm. So can you talk about the album that you've done that you've dedicated to your father, Ross?
Right. I'm releasing the album out. It should be coming out in a month, and if the Lord is willing. It's just it's really just, it has a whole bunch of strong messages on there to make people realize what's really going on in the world. You know, it's covering my life and really just the struggle of many people that's just like me. And, you know, it's just telling them just to put the Lord first and always stay on the move and never give up.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Ross Burr, the only son of James Burr Jr., the African-American man who was dragged to his death in Jasper, Texas, by white supremacists in 1998. At the time, Ross Burr, 19 years old, serving in the Army, now vigiling outside of the Huntsville death row last week, a few days ago, with Martin Luther King the Third and Dick Gregory and others opposing the death penalty for his father's murderers. That does it for the program. Also with us on the line was Gloria Ruback of the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement, speaking to us from Houston. I'm looking forward to heading to Houston this weekend and seeing listeners of KPFT on Friday night at Diverse Works, 8 p.m. Friday night. You can call the station at KPFT for more information. You can go to our website at www.democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. You can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. We'd love to hear from you. Also, there are some job openings at Democracy Now, an office manager and producers of Democracy Now, and you can send your resumes to job@democracynow.org. That's job@democracynow.org or mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's program, you can call the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, Michael Yeh. Anthony Reparations Sloan is our music maestro and engineer, and a lot of people to thank in the video crew, including Uri Galed and Noel Rabinowitz, Chase Pearson, as well as Emily Kunstler, Karen Renucci, and many more, Simba Russo, and all of the crew here at the Firehouse at Downtown Community Television, just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Let us know.